Internet Talk Radio. Asynchronous times demand asynchronous radio. This is Geek of the Week. We're here with Marshall T. Rose, theorist, implementer, and agent provocateur, as he describes himself. Marshall, welcome to Geek of the Week.
Thank you very much, Carl.
Marshall, you're known for a variety of things, but rather than starting with the subtle issues of protocol implementation, let's shoot a few ducks in a barrel. You're probably best known by some, at least, as the author of ISO-DE, the ISO development environment, and I guess that makes you the world's leading OSI implementer. Why do you like OSI so much?
Well, actually, I think we're shooting fish in a barrel, not ducks in a barrel, but probably neither is politically correct these days. It's true that back in 1986, Dwight Cass and I began a research project on implementing OSI, primarily over the upper layer, or the OSI upper layers, primarily over TCP. And, you know, that gave us a lot of experience in implementing OSI. At the time we started, we were really interested in finding out if the OSI stuff would work, and there certainly appeared to be a lot of promise. Unfortunately, and I think history will bear me out on this, or has already, the market's already shown us, that OSI per se, you know, has generally been a bad idea. The concepts, you know, of vendor-independent computer communications we all like, but when it comes down to the actual details and the way these standards are produced and the resulting technical merit, it's certainly been less than sterling. And, you know, now having implemented a lot of OSI stuff in the 80s, in the 90s, of course, I'm one of the more outspoken critics of OSI, which I imagine must drive the OSI people batty, since I often understand the standards better than they do.
Well, having actually implemented the standards can sometimes give you that insight.
Well, you know, certainly one of the things which is the strength of the Internet process is the fact that we intertwine standardization and implementation experience. And, you know, the way the current standards track works now, going from proposed to draft to full, there is an increasing burden on the part of the proponents of a specification to be able to demonstrate independent implementation, interoperable deployment, and so on. So by the time you finally reach, you know, the ultimate goal of having a full Internet standard, you know, we have excellent confidence in the workability and usefulness of this technology, and clearly that's something which has, you know, been lacking from the OSI process.
Well, why is that? Why is something so simple as let's get some code out there and see if it works missing from such a large scale process?
Well, there's the polite answer, and then there's the accurate answer. The polite answer, of course, is that you know, by and large, the ISO, the CCITT, the ITU, ANSI, the IEEE have kind of been overtaken by events. In the past, you saw international and national standardization of very well-defined technologies. For example, if you were going to build nuts and bolts, what the threads look like, and, you know, with the proper spacing and height and grip and so on. And so, you know, this is not rocket science. It's critically important to an engineer's infrastructure to have standardization of these things, but it's not as if we are trying to somehow codify the laws of physics. Now, in contrast, you look at computer communications, and what do you find? You know, this is extremely complicated stuff. It's none of it's very obvious. A lot of it is depressingly cutting edge, and yet, you know, the market seems to feel that they need a standardized product. And so in come the bodies which traditionally have done this in the international and national arenas, and they find out that they aren't standardizing existing technology, which in the past has been exactly what they did and why they were successful. No, they are doing research concurrently with standardization, but somehow their model for standardization never made this paradigm shift to including this implementation. You know, it's kind of like we could have the Congress of the United States pass a law with regards to time travel, but let's face it, you know, no one has a time travel machine, so what's the point of it? You can't change physical laws by making administrative policy. Why should you think you can standardize complicated technology without understanding it?
Well, some would argue that if you try to understand it first, you end up with a process which is not fair. And many people point to the ISO process or the CCITT process, and they say, well, we really have to make standards that are fair, that take into account all the views. Do you think that is maybe the reason that ISO has been continuing to move along that track?
Well, certainly every disaster in history has been very fair in penalizing the victims, hasn't it? No, let's be honest here. What we need to do is we need to produce solutions for the marketplace. And, you know, having some kind of a process which everyone is happy and gets apple juice and cookies and gets to express their, you know, their regional views and so on may be very fine for, you know, international relations, but frankly, you know, does not go one iota towards producing good technology. You know, Marty Schaffstall of PSI, a person I work for and have a lot of respect for, you know, one time he was giving a talk on his thoughts of standardization, and he says, you know, I'm really in favor of international agreements, but I also know that they don't work all the time. And so the audience is, you know, trying to figure out what Marty's talking about. He says, you know, for example, you know, there were international agreements in place, but we still had, you know, something like the Polish cavalry going up against the German army at the beginning of World War II. And what Marty's pointing out there is that, you know, there is a big difference between getting people together to sign a paper and agree that things are going to happen a certain way and having something in place which is actually going to produce workable results. And, you know, we have to keep in mind here that this is an engineering task. This is not a political task. And trying to solve engineering problems using political disciplines is almost bound to failure because, you know, you simply cannot compromise on what the value of pi or the gravitational constant are. I mean, how can a committee decide these things? These are like constants. You can't compromise a constant. What's the point?
You can have pi 1 and pi 2.
Well, and the...
And then you can have pi profiles.
And pi profiles, and then, of course, we could have various national character sets, and well, I'm sorry, that's another target we needn't go into now.
You know, some people look at that and they say, well, that's being unfair. There are certain things that different bodies do well, and many people point to X400, for example, as one of the success stories of the OSI process. Now, recently there's been a alternative set of standards that have come out of the IETF, known as MIME, Multimedia Messaging for the Internet. Could you compare those two? Do you think X400 is going to continue to gain steam or lose steam, and is MIME going to do something there?
Well, you know, certainly of all the things OSI has produced, one could point to X400 as being the most successful. On the other hand, that's kind of like saying that World War II was the successful conclusion of the Great Depression. And what I mean by that, of course, is that, yeah, you know, it's been adopted more than the rest of this OSI stuff, but it's still a complete disaster. You know, the technology you need to do store and forward mail is surprisingly simple. And, you know, it's not rocket science. There are some very basic architectural principles, and, you know, you may have to have some bells and whistles from time to time, but this isn't hard stuff. What the X400 people did is they started with a model which is fairly well regarded back in the early 80s, took some technology which had been fairly proven. This is, you know, the stuff that came out of Xerox with regards to data representation on the wire, and they built a mail system around it. And, you know, one could kind of argue about some of the choices they made, but basically it was kind of an overkill for what you needed. There is just far too much computational complexity to solve what is in theory a very simple problem. Now, unfortunately, after the great success of 84, instead of revisiting it and deciding how to make it simpler and more ubiquitous, they go on to the 88 version, and they don't even bother to figure out how to standardize migratory or transition paths between 84 and 88. It's kind of like, oh, let's just do this thing in 88 and we'll forget about the past, whether it was good or bad. Now, what the MIME approach does in contrast is the MIME says, let us assume that we have an existing electronic mail infrastructure, and now we are going to figure out the minimalist set of changes which we can add on top of that so as not to perturb the existing infrastructure, but still add these features to individual endpoints that want them. So if you look at, you know, the MIME spec, you notice there are some rules which really seem rather obscure. you know, do not do the following, do not do the following thing. And then there'll be a little note saying, the reason this rule is here is because we found in practice there is some mail software which behaves poorly under the following conditions, and we want to make sure that when you write MIME software, you don't exercise those problems. Now, you could say, well, you know, this shouldn't be the point of a standard, shouldn't have stuff like that in it. We should just assume that everything works well and people are going to faithfully implement this stuff. But, you know, again, in the real world, we see that's not the case. And the people who did MIME were very, very careful to make sure that the stuff they did would fit on top of and not exacerbate existing problems. Whereas, you know, you compare that to X400, there's just kind of this blanket assumption that someday everything will be X400 and we really don't have to worry about existing mail systems or what the effect we're going to have. And, of course, the result of that is that we see now a lot of, you know, X400 to, you know, such and such gateways, and those gateways really don't work very well because the feature match between X400 and say that the LAN mail system that they're gatewaying to is a very poor match. You know, the mappings are imprecise. You know, basically addresses are just hopelessly indecipherable, and it's a big mess.
Well, there you have it.
You're listening to Geek of the Week. Support for this program is provided by O'Reilly & Associates, recognized worldwide for definitive books on the Internet, Unix, the X-Window system, and other technical topics. Additional support for Geek of the Week comes from Sun Microsystems. Sun, the network is the computer.